Boxing fan, eat the ribs. Show your stomach you can, eat the ribs. Pull the rich ass from the power of a bank to shame. Swelling out the wrong one, but we know who to blame. And I'm tired of living it loud. Best if you can, eat the ribs. Yum, yum, yeah, eat the ribs. Yum, yum, yeah. Chemicals in your food, eat the ribs.
Yum, yum, yeah.
Now don't you think that that's rude? Gone, eat the ribs.
Yum, yum, yeah.
Oh, the bitch has the power of a bank to shame. Spreading out the love of what we know who's to blame. And I'm tired of living in a lie.
Show, not necessarily those. The opinions expressed on this show are not necessarily those of the Regents of the University of California, nor the management of KUCI. Coming up, an interview with an expert, a medical expert, talking about, are we overreacting to the anthrax scare? With us in the station is Dr. Ian Lipkin, and with me also to interview Dr. Lipkin is Stefano Sensi, assistant professor of neurology here at UC Irvine. Welcome, Dr. Lipkin.
Thank you, happy to be here.
Actually, Ian is a professor, I'm the professor of neuroscience here at Irvine, and he's also a professor of epidemiology at Columbia University, director of the Center for Development and Neuroscience, right? Okay, at Columbia, and it's a world expert in germs. He's actually the guy that discovered the West Nile virus two years ago, I guess. Okay, you are on. We have a few questions for you about, you know, this anthrax crisis. And first of all, any hint about what kind of bug is this one, this anthrax strain is?
Well, it's a bacterium that's been with us for a very long time. It's not a new, newly engineered virus or bacterium or pathogen, for that matter. There doesn't seem to be anything that's particularly pathogenic about this virus per se, except that it's been engineered and processed in such a way, at least in some of the exposures to date, so that it's been easily aspirated into the lower airways to cause pulmonic disease. But there's nothing unique about about this bacterium, and it's sensitive to the same types of antibiotics as other forms of anthrax. Anthrax, incidentally, is a naturally occurring bacterium, and it does cause disease in animals and people worldwide. So this is not something which is unique to a bioterroristic threat.
What I'm confused about is, wouldn't the person who sent it out get infected or get exposed? How would you protect yourself if you were trying to put it in envelopes, I mean?
All you would need to do would be to wear gloves and a respirator mask, a standard respirator mask, and then wash yourself after you placed it into an envelope, and there shouldn't be any problem.
And so they could come in capsules, tubes or something? Or
most likely people grew these up in large fermenters. These are just ways in which one can grow large numbers of bacteria. They would then be collected and processed, dried, so that spores would be available for use as infectious agents, and then someone would simply wear standard gloves and a respiratory, an industrial respirator mask. And as I say, if you simply wash afterward, you really don't have any risk of contracting disease. Alternatively, somebody might have simply placed themselves under prophylactic antibiotics at the time they placed the bacteria into the envelope so that they wouldn't have any risk of coming down with disease. This particular bug is very sensitive to a wide range of antibiotics, not just ciprofloxacillin.
Exactly. Actually, I don't know if you read an article yesterday by Lori Garrett. She was pointing out that there is a lot of emphasis on this Cipro drug. And maybe it's not the right answer for an epidemic, because this is a very powerful antibiotic that will actually select more resistant bugs.
I agree with Lori.
Okay, so you think that we should try a more rational approach, like penicillin, and go from there.
In Canada, apparently they got rid of the trademark or the patent for Cipro, and now today's New York Times said that the government there is going to allow generic versions to be bought by the government.
Yes, I read that as well.
But that's still the same thing.
It's still going to be the same drug. But yeah. There are lots of drugs in this class which can be substituted for Cipro, and as Stefano has already said, there are a number of other drugs which are also effective against this particular strain of anthrax. You don't need to go to drugs which are as powerful and as rare and difficult and expensive as ciprofloxacin.
So going back to this epidemic, actually, you know, as you said, there are many antibiotics that can treat the disease.
I would refer to this as an epidemic.
Okay. Excellent. So about
these are just a few sporadic cases.
So it's actually a treatable disease.
It is.
There are people thinking that this is actually a sort of diversion to get, you know, the labs busy, the system busy, when, you know, before the real strike, before something more serious.
I mean, that's a matter for speculation. If I were to be concerned about bioterrorism, anthrax would not be high on my list at this point.
Exactly.
With any of these sorts of agents, bacterial agents in particular, you don't get spread from person to person. So you have to have the initial exposure, and it has to be repeated amongst a large number of individuals. Now, bioweapon-eared anthrax could be delivered using things like crop dusters, and you could affect a large number of people. But far more dangerous would be spread of a virus.
Right.
Which could infect an individual and then exponentially grow and take out, you know, what we call the entire herd, which is a large population base. And there are a number of infectious agents that immediately come to mind. And in addition to the issue of human infection, you have the extraordinary risk associated with infections of animals. So an epidemic, for example, of foot and mouth disease, which would be very difficult to control, or of some other pathogen that infects animals, could have enormous economic consequences. But in fact, if you consider what the effects have been with this anthrax exposure, despite the very few people who've really had serious disease, we've shut down the House of Representatives, the Senate, you've caused enormous chaos, you've broken down trademark and patent laws in a major nation, that is to say Canada. So there's been extraordinary, extraordinarily damaging result, and the economy has suffered as well. I mean, you see people who are out of work who might not otherwise be out of work, and the stock market has tumbled, so it's had an enormous impact on us economically.
So basically, one could say that you got the best bang for the dollar with anthrax, because basically you don't kill many people, and yet, you know, the implication for the health system and you know, the society at all are huge.
Yeah, I think it's been an extraordinary result. I think we're way out of proportion to what it is.
But do you think the health system is the public health system is prepared for even more major crisis or not?
I don't think it's prepared. This has been an issue that's been discussed widely for the past 3 to 4 years. The whole concept of emerging infections, which really came to the fore with West Nile virus, illustrated the holes that we have in our system. What we really need on a national level is a different sort of an approach, what many of us like to refer to as syndromic surveillance. And the idea is that you have a system whereby people presenting with signs or symptoms consistent with an infectious disease are reported in real time to some centralized authority which recognizes patterns, geographic patterns, clinical syndromes, and decides therefore to go after in a more concerted way the pathogens that might be implicated there. This could be important not only for bioterrorism, but for other emerging infectious diseases like West Nile virus. It should also be applied widely to domestic animals, both because zoonoses are critical, that is to say, diseases which originate in animals and move to human beings, and also because it threatens our livelihood, our livestock, domestic animals, wildlife, and so on. And this concept of syndromic surveillance, which is discussed a great deal, is going to be quite expensive to implement. One of the major problems is coming up with a system that's sufficiently simple and elegant that a clinician who's already overburdened with issues like insurance forms and just getting the job done is able to record this information in a format that it can be evaluated by a data processor and crunched and constellations of symptoms recognize it might provide clues as to patterns or new patterns of disease.
Does this approach imply a major shift in paradigm from, you know, treatment to prevention? Something that is definitely missing in modern medicine, you know, the emphasis on some more preventive medicine, surveillance, you know, acting before, you know, the crisis happens.
You still ultimately come up with a requirement for treatment, but what you're able to do if you catch an outbreak at an earlier stage is you can contain it. As I say, this is extremely important in the context of viral infections. There was a Lasker Award given just recently to the person who recognized that this is the way to finally contain the last cases of smallpox. Rather than vaccinating everyone in the country, identify the foci where it was still present, and then to vaccinate in a ring around that focus so that you could use less vaccine and be more effective at controlling the spread of the virus. The same thing is going to be true in public health. If we can readily detect the presence of a new agent, and it might be a naturally occurring influenza virus for that matter, rather than a bioterroristic event, we can intercede more rapidly with the appropriate drugs or vaccines. And this is really going to be key. This is key in foot and mouth disease. It was probably would have been very helpful in the DSE outbreak in Britain in the 80s, but in fact it's very difficult to implement this because once you have a disease and many people are ill, it's easy to get resources in place to deal with it, but to recognize that the infrastructure has to be established first and that you have to find some ways to bring people into a network is much more difficult to justify, and it's difficult to get that money up in advance.
What system is in place now with, like, reporting to CDC and stuff like that?
What's required is that a very, you know, observant person or persons contact the appropriate health authorities and say, we think we have something unusual here. So it's really serendipitous. And if you have people who are too tired or simply not observant or what have you, you may not get the symptom complex reported in a rapid fashion. It's likely that we could have an enormous impact on a wide variety of infectious diseases if we had such a system in place. Now there is an effort to try to build such systems, and there's some money which has been allocated for doing this, but I don't see it happening on a large scale for a while yet.
How long did it take to discover that this was the West Nile virus? How long did that take?
Well, there was an infectious disease physician in Queens who appreciated that several of her patients with encephalitis had a particular difference to the types of disease that they normally show with encephalitis. They were very weak. And she contacted the Department of Health in New York City, and Marcy Layton, who was a former EIS officer at CDC, became involved in trying to sort out what was different. She appreciated there was something different about these individuals. And she then forwarded samples to the Centers for Disease Control, and they did some serology and determined that it was a flavivirus. It was likely to be important. But they were unable to capture any material and characterize it, and that's where we came in. We used the methods that we have here at Irvine to characterize the nucleic acids of this virus and found that, in fact, it was West Nile virus rather than the virus that they had implicated based on serology.
EIS is emergency.
No, that's these are
encephalitis.
Epidemiology Intelligence Service.
Oh, right. The CDC.
That's the CDC task force.
Right.
Typically, young physicians who spend 2 years or slightly more learning how to do biostatistics and epidemiology and outbreak investigation. And they do not just infectious diseases, but other things too.
How about the old stock of chemical biological weapons that the U.S. created and they stopped, you know, creating? What happened to the old stock, and is that a threat?
Well, the issue of bioterrorism and what we've done and what other people have done has been addressed very nicely in a book by Ken Allebeck, which if people are interested in getting more information, I'd highly recommend. Interestingly, although I don't have a great deal good to say about this gentleman, other than this context, Richard Nixon was the one who decided unilaterally that the United States should not be involved with offensive military weapons that of you know, biological type. And at that point, the Soviet Union continued to invest very heavily in these things. Now, do we have weapons? We don't really have weapons per se. What we've done is we've maintained stocks of these agents so that we can test vaccines for protective capacity.
Is that Fort Detrick?
There are really a couple of sites where this is possible. Fort Detrick, USAMRIID, has these agents, as does the Centers for Disease Control in Atlanta. And people work with these agents and try to make certain that we have the ability to deal with threats. We need to test, for example, protection against smallpox.
Right.
You know, we have to have the agent present. If you go back to the mid-90s, there was a lot of discussion about destruction of smallpox and what it meant to wipe out a species, and a great deal of debate. I guess we're all very glad that at this point we didn't do so. Now, the source of smallpox, if there is one, is not likely to be U.S. stocks. It's going to be stocks which are part of the former Soviet Union.
Exactly.
There are a number of scientists who were employed who lost that employment, and they had to find other places where they could do their work. I would imagine there are probably some other stocks as well in areas where smallpox was endemic. You have to realize that if you collect tissues from someone who's infected with an agent of this type and you store them in a freezer under the appropriate conditions, you can maintain it as a reservoir for the virus without keeping the virus in a concentrated form. So my guess would be, you know, when people talk about eradicating polio, which is another favorite point of discussion these days, you have to realize that it's going to be impossible to wipe out polio because it's in freezers all over the world because people have studied it. It's in the gastrointestinal tracts of people who've been given vaccine strains which have reverted to wild type and so on. So I think there are a lot of potential weapons that we need to be concerned about. And the question, of course, is if one were to appear, would we recognize it? Have physicians seen it as a presentation, an individual, an animal or a human being? And do we have vaccines and antiviral drugs which can be used to contain the infection? The answer is, in some instances, yes, but mostly no.
So actually, you answer most to the question. I read stuff about Kazakhstan. In fact, I was one of the largest places in which they used to get bugs, in particular smallpox and anthrax and stuff like that. And one might wonder, you know, what happened with, you know, the same deal that went on with the nuclear weapons. You know, there are so many scientists that do not have any job, do not have any, you know, money. And
you know, after the Second World War, the U.S. was quite, and the Soviet Union for that matter, were quite aggressive about going after scientists who had this sort of expertise so that they could bring them into their camp. And we could have done something similar, but unfortunately we didn't. So there are large numbers of scientists out there who may have gone over to the dark side, if you
exactly.
wish.
Exactly.
And I think this is something about which we do need to be concerned. There are other things. I mean, it's not just this. I mean, there are institutes in the former Soviet republics where they have extraordinary strains of bacteriophage and things that could be, things that could really do very good things for medicine, clinical medicine,
mm-hmm.
and we don't yet have these. We're losing these strains. They're not being maintained. I mean, you know, there isn't an appreciation anymore in the world of science and in government contracts for the notion that we need to preserve things just because we need to preserve them. They need to be collected and archived and curated appropriately and maintained. Viruses, bacteria are living things.
Stuff they're, like Ebola or Marburg, these kind of viruses are likely to be used as a weapon or are difficult to handle under for anything?
They could be used as weapons. There's no doubt about that. All of, I mean, any of these things could be used as weapons. The real question is whether or not a terrorist, you know, is willing to incubate this agent and become ill him or herself. Because this is not like anthrax, which we've already discussed as being something that you can distribute and not worry about becoming ill yourself. Smallpox, you know, you're going to have to find some way. You know, you can vaccinate yourself after you've got the disease, but I mean, if you're going to be actively shedding virus, you're going to be quite ill.
Right.
So if somebody were to try to smuggle in something of this sort on themselves, they would be taking a serious risk. Now, what's different about this particular culture is that people don't seem to be dissuaded by damage to themselves. They seem to be willing to sacrifice themselves for this cause. So maybe they would be willing to do so. But anybody who's ever seen a victim with smallpox, or even pictures of a victim with smallpox, would have pause.
Did they
giving it to themselves.
Did they stop the vaccination in 72, 73? In the United States against smallpox?
Right. I don't remember the precise date that was stopped.
Okay, so a large chunk of the population is not vaccinated.
Well, that raises another issue, and that's the level of protection with vaccines. You know, vaccines are very effective in the first 5 to 7 years after one receives smallpox vaccine. But if you're talking about someone who was vaccinated 30 years ago, that person is unlikely to have much protection at this point. In fact, there were instances where workers who were part of the vaccine program in Bangladesh who had been previously vaccinated as children came down with smallpox. So we don't have any data really on the number of people who could be protected by vaccines at the age of 7, if they're vaccinated at 7 or 10 or 15 mm-hmm. years of age. Those data just aren't available. My view would be that if vaccines were to come back, if this were to be an option, I would certainly want to be vaccinated again.
Mm-hmm.
Is this a UN problem? I mean, would UN be the place to, or World Health Organization, or who would take the initiative on setting up this kind of surveillance system?
Are you talking about surveillance for smallpox, or
for just like you were saying earlier that you need a something in place to prepare to see if there are patterns in certain types of?
This is very complicated. I think it's going to be a network of public health agencies. Individual countries are going to take responsibility mm-hmm. for this. To do this in the United States would be, you know, already extraordinarily expensive. I don't think the UN has the budget to do anything of this sort. The idea now, of course, is to find ways in which we can get the diagnostic tests sufficiently inexpensive that we can export this technology easily. And this is one of the thrusts of a program that I'm involved with through the Ellison Medical Foundation, this new program in global infectious diseases. We are trying to develop high-throughput methods for diagnosing microbial infections. We're trying to train people from third world countries who will then come and take that technology back with them so that they can employ it and presumably report that back to us in real time so that we can see whether or not there are new outbreaks with which we need to contend. There is an infrastructure for this over the internet, a program called ProMed, where local health people report internationally on the appearance of diseases of wild stock and plants and people and domestic animals and solicit advice from their colleagues worldwide. And they also post the results of tests so that you can evaluate what's going on. And it's quite striking. I mean, you can see anthrax worldwide. One of the ironic postings last week concerned an outbreak of naturally occurring anthrax in a little village in India. And people there were quite concerned about bioterrorism but hadn't considered the fact that there were sheep dying in the fields of anthrax. And they were continuing to eat these animals, getting GI anthrax and getting cutaneous anthrax from the wool. So I think we need to bear in mind that in addition to the bioterrorism, you know, Mother Nature's continually dealing us surprises as well.
So the spores came out of just plants?
No, these came out of... Spores of anthrax are quite resistant to desiccation and to, you know, to adverse environmental conditions. They can last for 60 years in the soil without any difficulty. Mm-hmm. So it's relatively easy for a group of animals to become infected. And if they become infected and they die, then exposure to those animals, particularly if you eat the meat and it's not been adequately cooked, could transmit the disease. And you can get a fatal case of anthrax from a gastrointestinal infection.
Yeah, last night, Stefano and I went to this so-called town hall meeting where the FBI and the Sheriff's Department reps spoke about terrorism in Orange County. And the FBI guy was saying that he thinks that the next step would be going to Ralph's or going to Albertson's and, you know, blowing up the place. But don't you think another possibility could be setting off some virus in a food store or something? Or contaminating the food stuff or somehow, right?
I think
that's easy way.
I think they're equally tenable.
I mean, this is maybe beyond your expertise, but you know, and yeah. Basically, no matter who is behind all this stuff, you know, they definitely show a diabolic mind because they sort of have a jiu-jitsu approach. They basically use the weakness of the opponent. And isn't that the case for the U.S. in terms of what is the system in place for health? You know, we still have 50 million of people uninsured, right, in the United States. There is no coverage for these people. So an outbreak or a serious mass infection could be incredibly serious.
I think that anybody who presents with one of these types of diseases is going to be so ill that they're going to wind up in emergency rooms. And frankly, these types of infectious diseases are going to be best appreciated in emergency rooms rather than clinics, because those are more likely to be connected with the syndromic surveillance system that I described for you. In New York State and in New York City, the emergency rooms are, in fact, the points of contact on which we rely for the syndromic surveillance, not individual physicians' offices. So I don't know that I feel very badly about the uninsured problem, but for other reasons, I don't think that it's going to have an enormous impact on this particular aspect.
Well, someone was actually making a comment about the system that is sort of just in time. The system is so after the dollar that basically there are not enough human resources or drug resources, you know, to cover a mass problem. So you have a minimal staff in the hospitals because they are not even, you know, remotely thinking about something like that to happen.
Well, I think that's probably changed.
It's going to change.
Have you been consulting in New York area on this, for the potential for a public health crisis?
I do a lot of consulting,
yeah,
all over.
What do you think, what are people telling you that is the next likely thing to happen, in general, I guess?
I don't think anyone knows.
Yeah.
It's, you know, it's a new era. I mean, as I said, my concerns are that we're leaving a number of holes. I mean, again, I think as with any other problem of this sort, there are challenges and there are opportunities. We can take what's happened here and we can improve the healthcare system and make it possible for us to recognize infectious diseases more rapidly, naturally occurring infectious diseases more rapidly, which will be helpful to us in the long term, irrespective of what happens You know, in terms of Taliban and you know
right.
these other characters that we're concerned about. Furthermore, I think that many of the technologies which will be developed as a result of the emphasis on infectious diseases, emerging infectious diseases as well as bioterroristic agents, will be useful in exploring the role of infectious agents in a wide variety of diseases of a chronic nature, ranging from coronary artery disease and autism to schizophrenia. So again, you know, when you look back at the history of military expenditures, you know, devices which were developed for surveillance wound up becoming part of neurobiology mm-hmm. and MRI scanning and so on. And our hope, of course, is that we will be able to take something from this which will be useful in the long term.
You know, there was a big controversy before over military troops being vaccinated. Do you think they were correct, those troops was correct to question like widespread vaccination?
I think that there are people who are who have reactions to vaccines, and those people are you know, it's a more difficult sort of a situation. If you know that you have reactions to vaccines and some vaccine components, then you're right in saying I would rather take the risk. And particularly in the case of anthrax, where the risk is only to the individual, it's much more difficult when you're thinking about something like a viral infection, and what you're trying to achieve is what we call herd immunity, so that if you do not protect yourself, then you're placing me at risk as well.
I see.
But that's not quite the same instance.
But one more question. Do you think this would spark like a drive for U.S. to create chemical biological weapons in response?
I can't see how that would be of any strategic advantage, and it certainly would be completely against the grain of everything we've done for the past 30 years.
Great.
Okay, so Lynn is extra super busy. In fact, he's going back to the East Coast almost immediately, right? So we have to say goodbye. Thanks a lot.
Thank you.
That was an interview we had with Ian Lipkin, Dr. Ian Lipkin, the neurosciences professor here at UC Irvine and at Columbia University today, about what he thought or what he thinks about anthrax and about the public health crisis that's looming. With us was Stefano Sensi, a fellow neurologist at UC Irvine. This is Subversity here on KUCI 88.9 FM in Irvine. The opinions expressed on the show are not necessarily those of the regents of the University of California, nor the management of KUCI. This is Dan Tsang. Tomorrow, Subversity is happy to co-host a forum on alternative media together with alternative radio show here on KUCI and also the Academia in Action and Act for Global Justice, two groups at UC Irvine. The talk will be happening at 3 o'clock tomorrow, Saturday, at Social Science Lecture Hall, which is in the Social Science Plaza at UC Irvine at 3 p.m. Speakers will be David Basamian, who is the host of Alternative Radio, Laura Flanders, Working Assets Radio, Sonali Kohatka, Afghan Women's Mission, and Glenn Nomura from the UCI Asian American Studies Program. So that's 3 o'clock tomorrow at UC Irvine's Social Science Lecture Hall. Also, coming up this Tuesday at 6 o'clock at Soka University will be a public lecture on U.S. involvement in Colombia and the war on drugs. And that's at 6 o'clock at Soka University, One University Drive in Aliso Viejo. And for more information, you can go to the website of this sponsoring group, which is called Wake Up Aliso Viejo. Wake Up Aliso Viejo at hotmail.com. Sorry, that's the email. Email is Wake Up Aliso Viejo, one word, at hotmail.com. And their phone number is 949-480-4608. 949-480-4608. And that's at 6 o'clock on Tuesday, a forum, a lecture with Piedad Morales, who is a member of the Colombian Women's Network, Peaceful Way of Women, who will discuss what she's doing for peace in the face of violence and terrorism in Colombia at Soka University on Tuesday. Coming up, we're going to play you the Free Speech Radio News, the newscast for today from the striking Pacifica Network news reporters who have been on strike for months against the Pacifica Network.
This is Free Speech Radio News for Friday, October 19th, 2001. I'm Verna Avery Brown. U.S. Special Forces troops are on the ground in Afghanistan. Bush visits China, where it's clear the countries see eye to eye on terrorism, but little else. Canada ignores the U.S. patent on the anti-anthrax drug Cipro. And African Americans speak their mind on issues from terrorism to patriotism.
Brother, my brother, blah. Someone has a flag on his car, and I said, "Bastard, bro, do you think that this flag on your car is going to prevent you from being racially profiled this evening?"
It is important to understand that democracy is not tested and proven in times of ease, but it is only tested and proven in times of adversity.
But first, these news headlines.
I'm Nell Abram with the headlines for Free Speech Radio News. Canada overrode the patent on an anti-anthrax antibiotic, Cipro, and ordered almost 1 million tablets of its generic equivalent from a Canadian producer, a step that President Bush has refused to take. Stephen Cooperman reports from Montreal.
Health Canada has asked Apotex Incorporated to infringe on the drug patent held by Bayer Incorporated. Bayer's patent does not run out until 2004. Bayer says Health Canada violated the Patent Act when it ordered the pills. Apotex charges about $1.50 per pill, compared to about $2 a pill charged by Bayer for the brand name version. The health minister says he's doing what is necessary to protect Canadians. Canadian pharmacists have been overwhelmed with calls from Americans asking them to fill prescriptions for either drug, to be picked up with cross-border shopping, or to be shipped with visiting Canadian relatives. Stephen Cooperman, Free Speech Radio News, Montreal, Canada.
The overuse of antibiotics can create drug-resistant bacteria, but overprescription of human medicine isn't the only cause of drug resistance. Evidence indicates that overuse of agricultural antibiotics is creating superbugs in our food supply. Kelly Ramirez reports.
Studies published in the New England Journal of Medicine suggest the widespread use of antibiotics in meat and poultry is contributing to the emergence of drug-resistant bacteria, and that these superbugs can survive and multiply in the human digestive system. The Union of Concerned Scientists estimates that each year, 24.6 million pounds of antibiotics are used on farm animals in the United States to prevent infection or promote growth, while only 2 million pounds are used to treat active infections. The European Union has banned the non-therapeutic agricultural use of antibiotics such as penicillin and tetracycline that are important in human medicine. Dr. Sherwood Gorbach, an infectious disease specialist, wants to see a similar ban in the U.S.
Well, the use of antibiotics does not improve the food supply. In fact, I would argue quite the opposite. It endangers the safety of the food supply.
For Free Speech Radio News, I'm Kelly Ramirez.
More than 10,000 Muslims marched through the Indonesian capital today in the country's biggest protest to date against the U.S.-led airstrikes in Afghanistan. The protesters, including hundreds of veiled women in white, marched from just outside the main mosque past the U.S. Embassy. Meantime, in India, violent demonstrations by Hindu extremists continue. Sputnik Kalambi reports from New Delhi.
The Indian opposition and anti-communal groups are slamming the storming of a disputed religious site in Ayodhya in northern India by Hindu extremists on Wednesday. The Prime Minister called it a major security lapse, but the Hindu fundamentalist VHP has challenged the government to take action against it. Wednesday's events come after Hindu extremists went on a rampage in the Taj Mahal, a monument built by a Muslim king, but nonetheless one of India's claims to fame. Meanwhile, there's continuing exchange of fire between India and Pakistan across the line of control. The Pakistan-based group Jaish-e-Mohammed has threatened more suicide attacks across India in response to the fighting in Jammu and Kashmir and the Hindu extremist action in Ayodhya. The Jaish was responsible for the suicide attack in front of the Kashmir State Assembly on October the 1st. Sputnik Hirambi in New Delhi for Free Speech Radio News.
Death penalty opponents in Houston accused Texas of violating international law by planning to execute Gerald Mitchell this coming Monday. Mitchell was a juvenile when he committed the crime for which he will die, and the United States is the only country in the world that does not protect juvenile criminals from execution. Meantime, the National Coalition to Abolish the Death Penalty is gathering in Raleigh, North Carolina. Mary O'Grady is there and files this report.
During the first day of the meeting, local activists described their efforts to get city and county governments to pass resolutions calling for a moratorium on executions. This is a conservative, largely rural southern state, but these North Carolinians have had anti-death penalty resolutions passed in 14 municipalities. This year, the North Carolina legislature also passed a bill forbidding the execution of mentally retarded people. On Monday, condemned prisoner Sherman Skipper, who has a mental age of 6.5, had his December execution stayed as his attorneys invoked the new law. This morning, Japanese attorney Maiko Tagasari reported the Council of Europe's recent warning to the U.S. and Japan. Both the U.S. and Japan must move significantly toward abolishing the death penalty by the end of 2002 or lose observer status at the Council of Europe. The U.S. and Japan are the only industrialized nations who continue to execute their citizens. For Free Speech Radio News, I'm Mary O'Grady in Raleigh, North Carolina.
For Free Speech Radio News, I'm Nell Abram. The United Nations reported today that thousands of Afghans streamed to the Pakistan border from the battered city of Kandahar, even as the U.S. government officials confirmed that a small number of American special forces were operating in Taliban territory in southern Afghanistan, aiding covert efforts to undermine Afghanistan's ruling militia. Correspondent Fariba Nawa is in Islamabad and is in regular contact with sources inside Afghanistan.
We've heard that there are ground troops as well as helicopters in Northern Alliance-controlled territories inside Afghanistan. And the Northern Alliance has confirmed that we don't know exactly the number of people inside nor what kind of operations they're planning. But the conflict right now is that the Northern Alliance is upset with the United States as well as one of their commanders. His name is General Rashid Dostum. Because these other commanders are saying that Dostum and the U.S. didn't consult with us and troops just landed here without our permission. They're in our territory and they don't have any right to be here until we have told them to be here. So fighting on the front lines with the Northern Alliance and Taliban has halted for the moment until this issue is resolved. They also talked about having forces inside Kandahar, which is the Taliban stronghold, and these forces are obviously spies, and no one we know has been able to confirm that. So it's very interesting that they have been able to infiltrate Kandahar, and we're looking forward to seeing what's going to happen next. As far as the refugees are concerned, this is quite important. About 3,500 Afghan refugees poured over the Pakistani border near the city of Quetta. They were all fleeing the fighting from Kandahar and other areas of Afghanistan. More than 60,000 Afghans have fled the country since the conflict started, and hundreds of thousands, perhaps millions, face famine, aid agencies are saying.
Correspondent Fariba Nawa in Islamabad. U.S. President George Bush today met China's president in Shanghai in his first trip abroad since the September 11th attacks. It's the highest profile encounter in a flurry of networking as heads of states arrive for the weekend summit of the Asia-Pacific Economic Forum, APEX. China agreed to share intelligence in Bush's declared war on terrorism, and there may soon be an FBI office in Beijing. But the two sides admitted that they still have differences. Tony Cross reports from Shanghai.
China pledged to work with the rest of the world against terrorism, but called for minimum casualties during the airstrikes on Afghanistan. And it's not clear if both sides will completely agree on who is a terrorist. Bush thanked Beijing for its speedy support after September the 11th, but he added,
"We've had a very broad discussion, including the fact that the war on terrorism must never be an excuse to persecute minorities."
That's presumably a reference to Tibet and the mainly Muslim province of Xinjiang in the west of the country. China wants U.S. help in fighting Xinjiang separatists, who have been held responsible for bombings in Beijing. And it wants backing for its alliance with neighboring Central Asian republics to combat Islamic guerrilla groups fighting there. The U.S. wants China to help trace finance for groups like Osama bin Laden's Al-Qaeda and is lobbying for Beijing to implement international treaties on the issue. Actually, China has signed more of these treaties than the U.S., but it hasn't yet set up a body to investigate money laundering. Meanwhile, the Hong Kong-based South China Morning Post reports that China has agreed in principle to the FBI setting up an office in Beijing to track down Al-Qaeda's money. Bush and Zhang both declared that great nations are bound to have differences. One of those is over the island of Taiwan, which Beijing says is rightfully one of its provinces, although it is effectively independent. Taiwanese representatives here have packed their bags and gone home after Beijing refused to invite either their president, Chen Shui-bian, or ex-vice president Li Yuanzi as his replacement. Usually a minister represents Taiwan's head of state at APEC meetings. Bush also made passing references to weapons of mass destruction and human rights, but he's optimistic that all would be for the best if China continues its integration in the best of all capitalist worlds.
"The long-run advance of Chinese prosperity depends on China's full integration into the rules and norms of international institutions. And in the long-run, economic freedom and political freedom will go hand-in-hand."
Later in the day, Bush met South Korean President Kim Dae-jung, a key ally in Asia and neighbor of U.S. hate state, North Korea. This is Tony Cross in Shanghai for Free Speech Radio News.
Fallouts from the September 11th attacks are hitting yet another group of Americans, undocumented immigrants in California. After the airplanes hit the World Trade Center and the Pentagon last month, California Governor Gray Davis told lawmakers he would not consider a law to allow undocumented immigrants to receive a driver's license in California. The governor said signing such a law would increase the chance of a terrorist strike. Mitch Jeserich reports from San Francisco.
Ellos producen los alimentos que el propio gobernador se come, que los asambleístas se comen, que los reporteros se comen, que el pueblo se come.
The reporters eat, que son los que tienen, que everyone eats. And the result is we have no rights. We have been forgotten. For this, people are still dying just to work in the fields.
Jose Sandoval from San Jose speaks for many of the country's 11 million undocumented immigrants who live in the United States. They work long hours and get paid little. In 1994, Californian voters passed Proposition 187, barring undocumented immigrants from public programs. But a year after the 2000 census indicated an increase of both immigrants and Latinos living in the state, both Republicans and Democrats have been engaged in a ruling contest for the immigrant vote. Last week, Governor Gray Davis signed a bill allowing both documented and undocumented immigrants to pay in-state tuition for community and state colleges. The bill was co-authored by State Assemblyman Marco Feuerbach from Los Angeles. He has been involved in many bills concerning immigrant issues.
The tenor and the mood of California has changed pretty dramatically since the bad old days of Proposition 187 in 1994. And I think it was a modest year for immigrants. And I think as regards undocumented kids, it was a very good year. Kids, particularly those that wish to go to college, that opportunity was opened up. That opportunity was opened up this year for the first time in 10 years.
In its original form, the bill also allowed undocumented immigrant students to be eligible for financial aid. But Assemblyman Feuerbach said that keeping this provision in the bill would at risk a veto by the governor. Davis ran for governor in 1998 as a friend to the immigrant community. Renee Chakraborty with the California Immigrant Welfare Collaborative says 2001 has been a decent year for the immigrant issues in California, in part because Governor Davis will be up for re-election come next year.
On the one hand, we've seen consistently during the last 3 years that he tends to be a little skittish when it comes to immigration issues, and that's both ones that deal with legal immigrants as well as undocumented immigrants. On the other hand, I think in many ways we've all had a tremendous year this year, again, largely because he is heading into an election year, and I think he's realizing that he needs to make good on a lot of promises he made coming into office.
Chakraborty also said that September 11th suicide attacks may halt the progress made for undocumented immigrants. Assembly Bill 60, which would allow undocumented immigrants to have a driver's license, was not passed this year. Los Angeles Assemblyman Gil Cedillo is the author of the driver's license bill. He says Governor Davis has indicated he would not sign the bill this year due to security concerns, but will sign a revised version of the bill in 2002. To get the governor's support, Cedillo changed his bill to allow only undocumented immigrants who had begun the legalization process to obtain a driver's license. But many undocumented immigrants avoid immigration services due to the fear of deportation. Cedillo says that the increase in terrorist threats increases the need for all immigrants in the U.S. to have some type of ID. He's hopeful this will open not just an avenue for a driver's license, but for legalization of the nation's undocumented immigrants.
I think there may be, on some level, a silver lining from the September 11th event, in that immigrants come here without any identity, and we've always argued that the question of identity theft isn't an issue that really affects immigrants. Immigrants usually lack an identity and live on the margins in the shadows of our society, fully integrated into the economic system, but not able to fully participate in the social fabric of our society. By requiring an ID for all Californians or everyone who resides here, we may end up creating a scenario where undocumented have a vehicle or have a means to become documented in California.
Before September 11th, the plight of the undocumented immigrant was gaining national attention. On September 5th, President Bush met with Mexican President Vicente Fox and said the U.S. was interested in liberalizing American immigration policy as soon as possible. But with the nation at war, immigrant activists worry the momentum for change may come to a halt, even as undocumented immigrants continue to make great contributions to the economy. For Free Speech Radio News, I'm Mitch Jezerich.
A Canadian health official ignored Bayer's patent for Cipro, one of the strongest antibiotics on the market to treat anthrax, by directing a Canadian company to produce a generic version of the drug. Canadian officials say their move is justified by the recent incidents of bioterrorism in the states. Stateside, United States Senator Charles Schumer is pushing the Bush administration to follow the Canadian lead and also authorize a generic version of Cipro. Schumer accuses Bayer Corporation of trying to thwart efforts to manufacture generic Cipro. Although Bayer contends it can supply enough of the antibiotics to meet the demand, others argue that the market must be open to generic providers. Cata Mesta reports from Washington, D.C.
Even before Canada moved to break Bayer's patent of the antibiotic Cipro, an investigation by the Federal Trade Commission discovered that Bayer conspired with generic companies to uphold its monopoly of the drug, prompting Democratic Congressman Charles Schumer to sponsor the Drug Competition Act of 2001.
This is one of the most pernicious things that is done. We give a generic company, one generic company, the right to produce the drug, and all of a sudden, they make a deal with the big drug company not to produce the generic. As Senator Lay mentioned, while the patent for Cipro doesn't expire till 2003, there was such a deal already between Bayer Labs and Bayer,
which would prevent the generic version of the drug from coming onto the market. Robert Naiman, senior policy analyst at the Center for Economic Policy and Research in Washington, says he is not surprised that the Bayer Corporation denounced Canada's move to manufacture 1 million doses of the antibiotic Cipro generically.
The fact that Bayer is against this is completely predictable without knowing any details of the situation, because the pharmaceutical companies are against any effort by governments to use their sovereign power to put the public interest ahead of the corporate profits of pharmaceuticals. pharmaceutical companies.
On the average, Cipro costs $8 per pill. Neiman argues that a patent is not a natural right, but granted by the government to a corporation in order to serve a public interest. Although U.S. law outlines procedures to override a patent during extraordinary times, the Bush administration said it was not going to do so. Neiman says the Bush administration's support of Bayer's patent is predictable. Prominent members of the Bush administration have occupied executive seats in major pharmaceutical companies. Neiman notes the resumes of Mitch Daniels, current head of the Office of Budget Management, who was former executive of Eli Lilly, and Donald Rumsfeld, current defense secretary, was a CEO of Searle.
You don't get to be Secretary of Defense or Secretary of the Treasury or the United States Trade Representative in either a Democratic or a Republican administration by being a labor leader, right? So I'm sure if you look at the resumes of all these folks, you would find that, you know, they come from corporate America.
The Senate currently seeks $10 billion to buy more drugs and vaccines to assist hospitals in the event of mass bioterrorist assault. Despite these efforts, there remains no serious discussion to purchase drugs from countries like Canada or India, who have been manufacturing these antibiotics and vaccines cheaply for years. For Free Speech Radio News in Washington, I'm Cutta Mester.
Many Americans have responded to the September 11th tragedy by expressing a newfound sense of patriotism. American flags are draped across doorways, hanging from buildings, and even stretched across foreheads. The pain and suffering has led many to seek security by closing out anything foreign or non-American. But some African Americans share a different reaction to the tragedy and feel their perspectives are viewed as unpopular and being ignored by the media. This week, Black Voices for Peace made their views known at a Black Community National Dialogue on War, Terrorism, and Peace. They spoke on issues ranging from defining terrorism to their brand of patriotism.
Terrorism. Does anybody have a dictionary? What happened on September 11th, no question, was terrorism.
Human rights and justice activist Amu Smith.
We have known terrorism in our community for a long time. And I'm telling you, I have been stopped in the middle of the night on some dark roads in the South by policemen. And I'm telling you, just having that policeman walk towards me the way he did was terrifying because I knew what had happened before that night to many others of my brothers and sisters in this world, in this society. So what I want to say to you tonight, sisters and brothers, is that when our government provides weapons and training to the Guatemalan military, and then when you have an international panel accuse our government of inflicting terrorism and genocide against the indigenous people of Guatemala, that was a policy of terrorism. And so I think that when we look at the difference in the nature of patriotism, we can't say one is less. We can't say one is different. We can't acknowledge that it is born of contradictions, the contradiction of being in Durban, standing in the tent of the Dalits and having them say to me, if your country leaves this meeting, then who represents you?
Maryland University political science professor Ron Walters.
Well, these are the people who in 1 month ignored us, slapped us in the face before the world. And in the next month, wants us to exercise the same kind of patriotism that they do. I'm not being that academic tonight, you can see. My final point is that I was
I was at a football game a couple weeks ago, and they were the very just, patriotic things that happened for about 15 or 20 minutes before the game started. And they had a unit of firefighters out on the field. I said, you know, that's great. That's a tribute to the firefighters. And everybody stood up, and they played the songs. Then they had a unit of the Prince George County Police on the field. Now, I said, anybody who expect me to stand up, go ahead. But you see, there were people looking at me as I sat there, evaluating the nature of my so-called patriotism, and not understanding that on that field was a unit that had the highest kill rate of black people in the United States of America. And I was not about to honor them.
Most people in this country do not realize what has just happened in the name of security.
Right. Professor of Law at Howard University, Nikichi Taifa.
Congress has just passed a bill that would give the government expanded powers to invade our privacy, to imprison people and punish dissent without due process of law. Both bills dramatically expand law enforcement agencies' power to conduct searches, conduct wiretaps, and other forms of electronic surveillance. By expanding the definition of terrorism, the bill could potentially allow the government to levy heavy penalties for relatively minor offenses, including people in this audience, political protests.
Brother, my block, that man has a flag on his car, and I sent bad for those. You think that this flag on your car is going to prevent you from being racially profiled this evening?
You've been listening to Free Speech Radio News, today's dispatch by the Pacifica Network News reporters who are on strike. This is Subversity here with Dan Zhang signing off for today's show. Thanks to Dr. Ian Lipkin for being on the show with Stefano Sensi. This is Dan Zhang signing off for Subversity. Coming up, Swope Transmission.